Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty podcast. In this episode, Baptist Joint Committee Executive Director Brent Walker discusses the first principles of religious liberty, which are God-given but government-protected. This is the first of three presentations for the 2013 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. This year's theme is Religious Liberty and Church-State Separation. Oh, what a touchy subject.
I'm reminded of a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. Some of you are too young, perhaps, to remember Calvin and Hobbes. They stopped appearing in the newspaper, in the funny papers, a number of years ago. But I'm reminded of one in particular where Calvin is sitting at his desk in class, and he's just raising his hand frantically. And his teacher calls on him, "Yes, Calvin?" And he says, "Miss Wormwood, I'm a fierce advocate of the separation of church and state, but I feel the need for some spiritual guidance and comfort as I face the day's struggles. So I was wondering if I could strip down and smear myself with paste and set fire to this little effigy of you in a non-denominational sort of way." And in the next frame, he's marching off into the principal's office saying, "Oh, what a touchy subject." Well, it is a touchy subject, and I've adopted that as the theme statement for my lectures today and tomorrow. They're touchy subjects because they both go to some very sensitive matters, to matters of the heart, to our faith or lack of faith in God, to our dizzying religious diversity in religious expression in this country. And it goes to what it means to be an American citizen and how we negotiate the political differences that we have one with another in this country that is all too often red and blue and not sufficiently purple, not just state by state, but in terms of our communities, our churches, our clubs, and even the TV shows that we watch. And they are touchy subjects because they are so often misunderstood. And I hope that these lectures will shed some light on the touchy subject of religious liberty and the separation of church and state. And I hope to be able to clear up some misconceptions that we may entertain about those topics. By way of introduction to the three lectures, let me do this quickly so we can kind of look ahead and know where we're going. The first lecture today, titled First Principles, God-Given but Government-Protected. In this lecture, I want to explore some theological and some historical underpinnings to the topic, and I shall talk about some generative ideas in our Baptist heritage and in our American history that serve to inform our understanding of religious liberty and the critical importance of an institutional and functional separation of church and state to ensure that freedom's viability. That's tonight. Tomorrow afternoon, the second lecture is titled First Freedom, Accommodate Religion But Don't Advance It. And I'll move beyond the theological and the historical to talk about some constitutional aspects. Having discussed first principles, I want then to talk about the first freedom, that is the two religion clauses in the First Amendment that are also first because they are the first 16 words in the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights. Ahead, up front, of all of the important protections for freedom of speech and press and petition and assembly. And I plan to emphasize the importance of having a strong free exercise clause and a strong no establishment clause and the limits to the accommodation of religion in our political system by our government. And then talk about some current issues that we face both in our work in Washington, D.C. and that we face as a nation as well. Then lecture three is titled Religion and Politics, How Did We Do in 2012? I want to shift our focus from the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights to Article 6 in the Constitution and Article 6's prohibition on religious tests for public office. And I plan to unpack how we go about upholding the separation of church and state, but at the same time affirm the relevance of religion to politics, all the while seeking to honor the letter and the spirit of the no religious test clause in Article 6, and then see how we did in this last election cycle in 2012. Well, it seems to me that that we ought to look initially to first principles, or that which lay in the backdrop of our understanding of religious liberty and the separation of church and state in contemporary American life. And to my way of thinking, this needs to be examined first theologically and then historically, both in terms of Baptist life and in other venues, including late 18th century American history. Any history majors, students? Any history majors here? Goodness sake. Any history professors? Oh, no. Gosh. What? I know. So I was hoping you could help me out some. So, well, thank you. Thanks. Do American history or world? All right. Okay. All righty. Good. I should say, especially with respect to this lecture, more so perhaps than the other two, much of what I know and much of what I will say will sound familiar to Buddy Sheridan if he were here, because I've sat at his feet and imbibed his wisdom for a number of years. I may not always cite chapter and verse in great detail, but just know that Buddy could give this lecture this afternoon better than I, and I owe so much to him and his good teaching, and I'm sorry that he and Kay were unable to be here tonight. Well, what informs my understanding of the proper relationship between church and state is a conviction that religious liberty is nothing less than a gift from God, not the result of any act of toleration or concession on the part of government. You know, one of the reasons Baptists have always championed religious freedom for others as much as for ourselves flows from our understanding of Scripture and what we read in the Bible. And although we don't find many specific proof texts, there are pervasive principles and suggestive inferences throughout the Bible. Our conception of religious liberty flows naturally first from our understanding of the nature of God. God is sovereign, and as such, God ordained government, but he did not delegate plenary sovereignty to human institutions, including government. God is seen throughout the Scriptures as a liberating deity who loves his people and cares about that relationship enough to create them to be able to say yes or no, to have a free choice. Because God wants a personal relationship with us, God does not want to control us like puppets. So hence, God is sovereign, God is free, God is personal, and God is loving. It also inheres in the condition of humanity. God created human beings in God's image. You know, whatever else the doctrine of the Imago Dei means, it suggests at least that we were created by God, free to respond to God's invitation. We are able to respond. We are responsible and therefore free. This is what we as Baptists have for the past 400 years called soul freedom, that God-infused liberty of conscience that we all enjoy simply because of God, who God is and how God created us and chose to relate to us. And even though created in God's image, human beings are still sinful and cannot be trusted completely to do right by each other in the exercise of absolute authority, particularly in government and other coercive institutions. One does not have to be a thoroughgoing Calvinist, and I certainly am not, to understand the fallen nature of human institutions. One only has to pick up the newspaper in the morning. the nature of God, the condition of humanity, and finally, the imperative of faith supports religious liberty. For faith to be authentic, it must be free. Faith cannot be coerced and be genuine at the same time. It's an oxymoron. Jesus, for example, did not go chasing after the rich young man in Mark chapter 10 when he declined to sell all he had and to give it to the poor, but instead Jesus let him go away sorrowfully, the text says. Yes, Jesus knocks, but Jesus will never kick down the door. And the teachings of Jesus, as much as his actions, inform our understanding. One of the best known stories is the encounter, of course, between Jesus and those two most unlikely of allies, the Herodians and the Pharisees. Their mutual disdain for Jesus bridged their divisions and caused them to come together to ask him a question that was just bound to get him into hot water. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? They asked. If Jesus said yes, his credibility with the Jews would be ruined. But if he said no, then the Romans would charge him with sedition. Either way, Jesus loses, right? Not at all. Of course, Jesus avoided their snare, and he would not be trapped. He said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Now, Jesus here is not articulating a constitutional doctrine of any kind. He's not talking about the wall of separation between church and state 1,600 years before Roger Williams started to talk about it. No, rather, he is noting the existence of two kingdoms of which we owe different duties and loyalties. But his teachings here do lay something of a groundwork, a theological foundation for a constitutional doctrine that does mature and come into being some 2,000 years later. The Apostle Paul announces the centrality of freedom time and time again. Yes, he's often talking about freedom from sin or from religious legalism, but his ringing words in Galatians that for freedom Christ has set us free at least is congenial with the modern notion of freedom from governmental interference. And at least for Trinitarian believers, Paul's announcement that, quote, "where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom," clearly makes God present in freedom a very liberating thought. And finally, the language, "whosoever will," ... that we find so many places in Scripture, is a pervasive theme throughout the Bible, particularly the New Testament. "Whoever will come" implies voluntary religion through and through, and free will on your part and mine. Yes, Baptists became champions of religious liberty and church-state separation in large measure because we have always been people of the book. Early Baptists did not set out to discover Baptist distinctives that we are so fond of talking about. Rather, they just happened upon them first and foremost by studying the Bible. Well, Baptists also valued religious freedom and the separation of church and state because they suffered the hard lessons of history. Their understanding was not just academic, it was existential. Early Baptists experienced firsthand the pain of persecution and the heartache of bloodshed occasioned by religious zealots armed with the coercive power of government. From jail cells in England to stockades in Massachusetts Bay to whipping posts in Virginia, the historical litany is familiar to our ears. After establishing the first Baptist church on English soil, Thomas Helwys, H-E-L-W-Y-S, Helwys, authored a seminal treatise on religious liberty called A Short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity in 1612 and sent off a copy to King James I. And in his inscription, Helwys wrote, "The king is a mortal man, not God, and therefore hath no power over the immortal souls of his subjects to make laws or ordinances for them and to set spiritual lords over them." Sounds pretty ho-hum today, doesn't it? But back then it was a revolutionary utterance. And for his trouble, Helwys, along with his wife Joan, got himself thrown into Newgate Prison there in London, where they languished for several years and then perished. Often called the apostle of religious liberty, Roger Williams came from England to Massachusetts Bay in 1631, preaching and teaching that soul freedom that we've already talked about, the notion that faith cannot be dictated by any government authority, but must be nurtured freely and expressed directly to God. And he advocated a, quote, hedge or wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world, end quote. We often give that line to Thomas Jefferson, but it was Roger Williams a century and a half before who first talked about the hedge or wall of separation between church and state. And the theocrats in Massachusetts were so offended that they kicked Williams out of the colony, and he trekked to what would become Rhode Island in the middle of the winter, surviving its frigidity only with the help of the Narragansett Indians, and went down and founded a town that he called Providence because he judged that God's providence had taken him to that very spot. And Williams began that lively experiment of religious liberty and founded the First Baptist Church on North American soil. And you can still go visit First Baptist America right at the foot of the hill below Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Obadiah Holmes, also banished from Massachusetts because of his Baptist beliefs, settled in Newport, Rhode Island, seeking religious freedom for himself and his family. In 1651, Holmes, along with John Clark and John Crandall, traveled back to Massachusetts to visit a friend who was aged and infirmed and blind. And after taking communion at the friend's home, they were arrested for engaging in unlawful worship. Holmes was convicted and sentenced to either a fine or a whipping. And when he refused to pay the fine because of conscience, he was whipped with 30 lashes. And as his punishment was being administered, Holmes was reported to have told his tormentors, "It was as if you did strike me with roses, brothers." And after his release, Holmes returned to Newport and served as pastor for another 30 years. An evangelist preaching in Virginia during the heady decade of the 1780s, John Leland, boldly advocated religious freedom and the separation of church and state. And Leland and other Baptists played a pivotal role in convincing our nation's founders of the need for a specific guarantee protecting religious freedom in the Bill of Rights. And he stood toe to toe with the likes of Madison and Mason and Jefferson, never backing down on the way to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. He later returned to his native Massachusetts, where he continued to speak out in favor of religious liberty and against state-established religion. Isaac Backus, Baptist freedom fighter, preacher, social activist, and a popular pamphleteer, a contemporary of but about 20 years older than John Leland, Backus has been called the most forceful and effective writer in America that was ever produced on behalf of the pietistic or evangelistic theory of the separation of church and state in colonial times. Backus agreed with Leland that government should not tax its citizens to support the teaching of religion, and that the government had no power or authority over the church. Well, this pantheon of early Baptist freedom fighters, and I can name a dozen more, testifies to the Baptist heritage of, of being trailblazers for religious liberty. Such a cloud of witnesses inspires modern-day advocates in general and Baptists in particular for truth-telling to the powers that be in defending religious liberty and the separation of church and state. Hundreds of years separate these witnesses, but time has not silenced their voices. Well, against this backdrop of centuries of religious persecution and intolerance in England and in most of the colonies, our nation's founders assembled in New York in 1789 to adopt a Bill of Rights to the new Constitution. Our forebears understood that when religious zeal gets combined with a coercive power in the state, consciences are violated and persecution almost inevitably results. Old practices die hard, though. Yes, the Puritans came to New England in search of religious freedom, but what they got for themselves, they turned around and denied to everybody else. People like Roger Williams and Quaker Mary Dyer. Moreover, all but four colonies, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, had officially established churches and engaged in a variety, in varying degrees of persecution and intolerance. All but two had religious qualifications for public office. Five denied basic civil rights to Catholics, and several made blasphemy a capital offense. Yes, old practices die hard. But the wise architects of our republic had a different vision for the new national government. The Constitution, adopted in 1787 in Philadelphia, never mentioned Christianity and spoke of religion only one time, there in Article 6, and then in sort of a negative way to disallow any religious test for public office. And with the adoption of the First Amendment's religion clauses in the Bill of Rights, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Our founders made clear that one's status in the civil community would not depend upon a willingness to sign on the dotted line of any religious creed or confession. Religious liberty is often called our first freedom, both because of the widespread conviction that religious liberty was nothing less than a gift from God, and because it was the first right ensured in the First Amendment. Both religion clauses were put in there to protect religious liberty, but in different ways. The Establishment Clause keeps government from advancing or privileging religion and from violating the consciences of those who have no religious belief. And the Second Clause, the Free Exercise Clause, keeps government from burdening or interfering with religious practice unless government can assert some paramount interest, such as peace, safety, health, welfare, or the good of society. And we'll talk more about this tomorrow in the second lecture about those two clauses particularly. But they were put there by our founders for a reason, and right smack up front, in front of all the rest. It's important for us to recognize, as we look back on those seminal days in our country's history, that the children of God and the sons of the Enlightenment work together to develop governmental institutions that would protect what the former believed to be a gift from God and the latter a natural right or the right of conscience. I don't think that either one of those two parties could have done it alone without the working together with the other. William Estep, a Baptist historian from a generation ago, teaching at Southwestern Seminary, so ably told us in his book, Revolution Within the Revolution, that the First Amendment's protection for religious liberty was adopted simply because of the support of the so-called twice-born, the evangelical dissenters of the 18th century, Baptists and Presbyterians and Quakers and other free church folks. They were so important to that coalition. And no less a scholar than conservative jurist and professor Michael McConnell understands the importance of this partnership. McConnell notes this, quote, "The evangelical position ultimately coalesced with the secular liberal position as against the dying tradition of civic republicanism." This explains why more fervent evangelicals, including Baptists, tended to become Jeffersonians, notwithstanding the deism of Jefferson and the piety of his opponents. Religion, the evangelicals believed, was vital to civic harmony, but voluntary religious societies, not the state, are the best and only legitimate institutions for the transmission of religious faith, and with it, virtue. End quote. And that's why, among many other reasons, that the Baptist Joint Committee is totally okay with cooperating with the American Civil Liberties Union and People for the American Way and other groups that come after the issue of freedom from a more secular point of view. We have good precedent in this country. Our forebears did the same thing. And permit me another brief excursus here. Some today in the religious community, even in the progressive Baptist community, see our current drive to perpetuate religious freedom and church-state separation as rooted only in the Enlightenment, not in theology or biblical principles. And I hope that my remarks today dispel that canard. Because, as Buddy Sheridan has said many times, the Baptist got it. The Baptist got it long before the Enlightenment thinkers came upon it. Thomas Helwys predated John Locke by nearly a century. Roger Williams preceded the Enlightenment thinkers of the late 18th century by at least 150 years. And even in modern times and post-modern days, Baptists and other people who advocate for religious freedom and the separation of church and state continue to find their moorings in the Bible as much as, if not more than, in secular notions of the contours of freedom, however important they are. Yeah, our nation's founders, supported by my Baptist forebears and, yes, armed with Enlightenment values, in my view, wanted to ensconce robust protection for religious liberty in those documents. That is to say, they intended to write a strong establishment clause and a strong free exercise clause. You know, we hear a lot about original intent these days from several members of the Supreme Court and others. It is very dicey to try to judge the original intent of our founders. First of all, there is no monolithic intent to be discovered. There were many intents, plural. And even conceding that point, intents, plural, are hard to pin down and to translate into common practice. Don't forget, there were spin merchants back in those days, too, just as there are today. Our founders were politicians, smart, able, but still politicians. So it's really hard to come up with some overarching, monolithic intent that we can ascribe with any degree of certainty. That said, the words of the First Amendment and the surrounding history that we can evaluate lead me to conclude that they intended very strong protections for religious freedom. You know, some say that the Establishment Clause was intended only to keep government from setting up a single national church or showing preference among faith groups, but not intended to forbid aiding all religion generally. I think they are absolutely wrong. If all our founders wanted to do was to simply ban a single national official church, they didn't do a very good job of saying so in the First Amendment. In fact, in an early draft of the amendment, these words appear: "The civil rights of none can be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national church be established." But that draft was passed over. It was done away with. And the founders had ample opportunity to state that the government should not be allowed to, or that the government should be allowed to promote all religion on an even-handed, non-preferential basis. But the Congress repeatedly rejected versions of the First Amendment that would have explicitly permitted such non-preferential aid. For example, the Senate rejected this proposed language. Quote, "Congress shall make no law establishing one religious sect in preference to another," end quote. Rejected. And they rejected two more proposals with provisions embodying similar language, such as, "Congress shall make no law establishing any particular denomination of religion in preference to another," end quote. No, the founders approved and embraced much more expansive language to keep the new federal government from making laws even respecting an establishment of religion. Religion generally, not a religion or a national religion, but no religion at all, period. They did not merely want to keep the federal government from setting up an official national church or to ban denominational discrimination. At the same time, a robust free exercise clause was intended to, or was at least consistent with, the notion that sometimes religious practice must enjoy an exemption from generally applicable laws that have to be abided by everybody else. By the time the First Amendment was crafted, almost every state, with the exception, I think, of Connecticut, had a state constitutional provision protecting religious exercise, specifically in words. Those provisions in state constitutions generally protected not just belief, not just the rights of conscience, but also actions based on those beliefs. The exercise of religion, not just the right to worship or the cause of conscience internalized. That protection could be compromised by the state only in rare circumstances where, quote, peace and safety, or, quote, civil injury or outward disturbance of others, or in some cases, licentiousness. I'm still not sure the meaning of that word in the context of the late 18th century. Only when those narrow circumstances were present, in the interest of the betterment of the society at large, could the free exercise of religion be compromised by the states. In short, according again to Professor McConnell, both the affirmative free exercise protections and the peace and safety limitations flow logically from the liberal and evangelical theories of government and provide a foreshadowing of the robust protections afforded for religious liberty in the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. And actual free exercise controversies in the pre-Constitution period often resulted in exemptions for religious scruples. Tomorrow we'll talk about today's free exercise issues. Back then, the actual controversies that they faced and how they faced them tell us a lot about how seriously our forebears took the free exercise clause. These controversies had to do with refusal to take oaths in giving testimony in court, Quakers and others, opposition to military conscription, Quakers, Mennonites, and others, objections to assessments and compelled tithes, Baptists and Quakers, other issues such as refusal to remove one's hat in court as a sign of obeisance to civil authorities. All of those controversies, generally speaking, throughout the colonies, resulted in an accommodation for religious exercise on the part of colonial governments. True that these exemptions were granted by the legislatures and not the courts, but it's reasonable to assume that the legislatures granted the exemptions because they believed that the free exercise principles required them, not just because they were good policy. And this view translates nicely in an age of judicial review that we have today to a principle that would allow the courts to grant similar exemptions as a matter of constitutional entitlement. Now, the historical record argues persuasively that we have inherited constitutional constructs that were intended to provide strong protections for religious liberty.
That was Baptist Joint Committee Executive Director Brent Walker delivering the first of three presentations for the 2013 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. The lectures were given on the campus of Stetson University in DeLand, Florida. All three lectures are available on video and in podcast form. For more information, visit our website at bjconline.org/lectures.